Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is someone I just love having here because every time I talk to him, I learn something. And we were talking the other day about an issue, and I had said, come do a Love Letters with me. And here we go. It's Noah Griffin, who is... Noah, how do you like to be introduced? Because you do so many things.
Janet Gallen's friend.
Oh, thank you. I like that. Okay, Noah has founded the Cole Porter Society. Noah started out with a law degree from Harvard and didn't want to be a lawyer and has done many other things and continues. And he knows a lot. He is basically, I think you're basically just really a fabulous historian.
I love history. I'm a lifelong student of history.
Because even in your concerts, when I've heard you sing.
Well, what I try and do is give the history, the background, the song, the composer, the time in which they were composing.
Yes.
In fact, I just did a piece with the Commonwealth Club a couple of weeks ago.
On
Cole Porter, and read another book on Cole Porter and found some new things that I didn't know about him before.
And I remember the first one I went to, it was Sammy Davis Jr.
Yes, we're going to do another one of
his. It was fabulous, but what was also exceptional was how much I learned about that era.
Yes.
And not that I didn't live through it. I'm not trying to pass myself off as a 30-year-old here. But still, your focus was on the history of the time. It was great. Okay, this one is going to be history.
Okay.
Because we were talking about the woman who climbed up the flagpole and tore down the flag, and I thought, let's just talk about this.
And it wasn't the American flag. It was the Confederate flag, and that was right when Nikki Barber, the governor of Alabama, came up with the idea that she's going to take that flag down.
Nikki Haley. Okay, but background, when the governor came up with the idea that she...
Well, what happened was, obviously, they had the massacre in the church.
Right.
And the state senator was slaughtered among other people there, and she decided that it was time to take that symbolism.
She decided it
because the young man, Dylan Roof, who did the massacre, took pictures of himself with a Confederate flag. Mm-hmm. It was stark relief of what people wanted to deny for so many years, that it was Confederacy, slavery, anti-black bigotry.
And it's still a symbol of hatred.
Yes, it is.
That's the point. Because, you know, I see that. That's something that just chills me every time I see one.
Well, and that's one of the reasons.
Because what does it stand for? It stands for...
The Confederacy. It can't stand for slavery. It stands for the rebels and the Civil War.
And then later, it stood for murder.
Right. Well, it was revived back in 1961, right in the height of the Civil Rights Movement, and that's exactly what it stood for. People took that flag out, and that's when it became the official symbol of these various states, and that's when you start seeing it waved. It's resistance to integration, resistance to black rights, mm-hmm. and civil rights, and human rights.
Okay, so talk about her going up and pulling this down.
Well, before the time of actually taking the flag down, she decided to take it upon herself to shimmy up that flagpole and take it down because too long had it been a symbol of what America's supposedly not standing for.
Right.
And so I supported her in that effort, just as I support renaming the Dixie School District in the heart of Marin County.
Okay, so the essence here is, how long do we have to put up with things that are part of our culture in some definite way, but based on something really bad?
That's offensive. And I hate when people say, well, it's politically correct to have, it's not politically correct to be able to say what you want to say or have symbols that you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
And once we become sensitive to what upsets other people, mm-hmm. and we don't use that symbol, we don't say those words, then we understand that it's a matter of polite correctness.
Okay, so I like that point because you cannot legislate how people feel. You just can't.
You can legislate their behavior. You can't legislate what they say.
And sometimes feeling comes with better behavior. You see the point in the feeling from your own better behavior. But even if you don't, the next generation will.
Right. Then each generation's feeling is the next generation's floor. They take what's right and from that generation, and then hopefully they move forward. And if they find out something's new, then they move that forward one rung. You have to have enough energy and enough will to make the whole society, a whole ladder better, to make it one rung better in many instances. And then the next generation climbs on that particular rung to make it another.
So talk about the Dixie School in Marin County.
Well,
and for those of you who are listening to this throughout the world, Marin County is a county in California.
That presumes that it's geographically liberal. Yeah. It's across the Golden Gate Bridge. And it does vote Democratic most of the time. It does have liberal ideas and views, by and large. However, it has inherited a Dixie School District, which was named in 1864. It was part of a land grant given to a guy by the name of Miller. And he...
Given by whom?
Don Timoteo gave it to him, and who established that land in 1853. Mm-hmm. And it was claimed later that it was named Dixie because he had a daughter by the name of Dixie. When you look up a quick Google search, he had no daughter. He died as a bachelor. Mm-hmm. So he gave this land to this miller who named it on a bet and on a dare, and as we can understand it, would trade Indians and Chinese slaves with somebody from another land grant. So that's the history of it. So it has a history based on what it was named during the Civil War, represents Confederacy, represents slavery.
But is that why the name Dixie was chosen, because of this other slave swapping?
Yes, it was named that because of that.
Oh, because it was an area where...
It was a Confederate sympathizer that dared him to name it Dixie based on what was going on during the Civil War. So he names the school Dixie, and he names the area Dixie, and it stayed that way for lo these many years.
Is it still?
It still is. In 1997, mm-hmm. they brought it up before the school board to consider changing the name, voted down again in 2003. I went with Carrie Pearson there before the school board, recall all kinds of derogatory names, told to go back where we came from. Mm-hmm. And so we figured after they lowered the Confederate flag, the time had come for the good people of Marin County to assume their enlightenment and rename it. Mm-hmm. Well, I got a whole barrage of letters against the op-ed piece which I wrote to say it's time to rename it. I'm mm-hmm. sure that the good people in Marin County would. Then the newspaper, the Marin Independent Journal, came out on behalf of our cause. It's time to reconsider, mm-hmm. to consider renaming the Dixie School District. So mm-hmm. it's coming up this fall, and we will see what happens.
So what has the reaction been?
The reaction has been probably 3-1 against. So we're going to have to...
Isn't that odd?
Well, it is odd to us because I think, you know, we're only 2% black people in Marin County, but nonetheless, it's an educative opportunity. It's an opportunity to say...
But still, you can still see that it's an offensive name.
They want to say that it's not, that it's that's not offensive, and they want to tell you who is offended that it should not be offensive to you. But as Abraham Lincoln said, only he who wears the shoe knows how tightly it fits. And so if it is offensive to a group of people that name represents something to... then why not remove it?
Oh, not only that, if you can document it, that it has an offensive history. Well, I mean, you can't have everybody coming in and saying, well, I just don't like that name because of some personal reason, but this is documentable.
Most people don't deal on reason. Most people deal on belief and emotion. That's what moves them. People think based upon their ideas. They act based upon their beliefs.
Who are the people who are against changing it?
People have been longtime residents there, people who say we're being politically incorrect or trying to be politically correct, people who claim we don't have children in the school districts and our tax dollars don't really support the school district. We live in Marin County. Our tax dollars do support the school district.
They see this as some outsiders coming in.
Well, they don't want to say outside agitators, but that's exactly what they were. That's what they called Martin Luther King when he would come into an area that he didn't live, an outside agitator. Well, if it's wrong, it's wrong, whoever points it out. It doesn't need to be somebody that lives in the area to point out that it's wrong.
What are some other instances of that? I'm sure there are lots of them.
Most recently, President Obama has gone to Alaska to rename Mount McKinley Mount Denali, because that's the way it was for many, many years, for the Inuits and the folks that actually lived there. Uh-huh. And so now there's a movement upon the conservatives in Congress, particularly the people in Ohio, because McKinley came from Ohio, and it was Mount McKinley before. So times change.
And why was it named Mount McKinley?
It was named, I think, under President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson at the time. They just decided that that was what they were going to do.
Now, do you remember, I know this is really... a little, I don't mean to be glib in any way, but do you remember when Constantinople was renamed Istanbul?
Istanbul, Constantinople, yes.
That seemed to have gone rather smoothly.
Well,
and then we got a popular song out of it.
Stanford changed the name from the Indians, and the Redskins now, that's undergoing a real controversy in Washington, D.C., right. Whether or not they should name that. So things change. I think it's James Russell Lowell said, new occasions teach new duties. Mm-hmm. Time makes ancient good uncouth. They must ever up and onward who would keep abreast of truth. Roberto Clemente was called Bob when he played baseball, and he said, no, my name is Roberto. Muhammad Ali was called Cassius Clay. He said, no, I want to be known as Muhammad Ali.
So I want to be known as... And
eventually,
you have to respect that too. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
People
have
the right
to be called.
I wonder how many people even remember his birth name.
Not many now, because he's so morphed into the history of the times, and we know.
And because there are two new generations since that happened. You know, we met him.
Because I think it was 1964 when he became heavyweight either heavyweight champion or he became, I think he won the Olympics, very close to that.
So people, it's funny because people don't have any trouble with actors changing their names. I mean, stage names, that's a very...
No, you're Bernie Schwartz. You're not Tony Curtis. Jane Persky, I think.
She was Lauren Bacall. She didn't do that. I think she stayed right. But people had reasons to change. Yes.
That's absolutely right. That's how, and they had reasons to be respected for the change.
Right.
You have a right to call yourself as you would like to.
And by the way, some of that reason was just because of bigotry.
That's
they knew they wouldn't
right.
get work under the other name.
That's absolutely right.
You know, because we live in a society that likes things a certain way, yes.
Well, I was watching Paul Newman and Piper Laurie in The Hustler, a redo of that. And she changed her name as
well. I don't know
that. Yeah. Yeah, so it, for the same reasons.
Right.
So people, I think, need to be respected in society. It's a power thing. You're not going to tell me what to do when I don't want to do it.
Well, that's the issue, right, the power thing. Now, talk about, this isn't, well, it's kind of another issue, but you had mentioned it, about the women who were thrown off the wine train. And I read that, and I didn't know why they were thrown off.
Well, there were a number of black women that they belong to a book club over in East Bay, and once a year they take a trip on the wine train up in the Napa Valley.
And that's a train that serves dinner and goes through...
Goes through the wineries, and I think people get off and they have tastings and they come back on the wine train. And what happened is one particular customer, passenger who happened to be white, thought that they were laughing too loud. They were having too much fun and told them to tone it down. Well, I think the conductor may have come one time at her request and told them to tone it down.
Mm-hmm.
They were ejected from the train with a police officer waiting for them as they were ejected from the train. And you had, in one instance, an 80-year-old woman there and these other women. They were saying, you know, why should we be kicked off a train for having too good a time?
That's right.
And so that's been a big controversy now. And it's turned into something, a big PR snafu for the wine train. And something that the
that's particularly bizarre because any restaurant you go in for dinner in San Francisco or Los Angeles is so loud that your only choice is to scream over that, and it ratchets up to the point where everybody knows restaurants in these areas are really unpleasant because you can't hear.
And so you choose a quieter venue if that's what you're looking for.
Right.
So it's interesting to see how... Again, the power of one woman to complain took a whole group of women off a train. And, of course, it turned into a larger incident than she probably would have liked, and certainly the wine folks would have liked.
Now, she could have moved to a different car or something, right?
That's true, too.
Yeah. People are nuts. What other kinds of things, like taking the flag down, the Confederate flag, is that... I mean, there are Confederate flags all over the South, are there not?
Yeah, I think, we're not trying to ban the display of that in anybody's particular home, but officially sanctioned.
Okay.
There's another move afoot to take down the statues honoring people who fought in the Civil War. There's a Confederate general by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a brilliant general for the Confederacy. But he was also a war criminal. He slaughtered 300 black troops under a flag of truce.
Oh, and so there's
he
a statue.
He began the Ku Klux Klan in Pulaski, Tennessee in 1865. There are statues of him throughout the South. And there are moves to take those statues down. Not that we don't ignore the history. Put it in a museum. Mm-hmm. Put it in a textbook. But don't honor it. Don't praise it. Don't make it something worth of emulation.
Yes.
So we're not trying to erase the history. But
you're saying you're not trying to erase the positive things that he did as a general?
Well,
I mean, you could go say that about Mussolini and Hitler also, and people do. That's pretty...
Well, I guess the things that if you want to study what they did in terms of troop movement, in terms of battle strategy, I think that's one thing. But if you want to honor them...
No, I understand that. But is it even necessary to hold them up as... So you're saying you can't just erase somebody from history?
No, nor should you. I think one of the things that the president said was keep the flag, but put it in a museum. Have it flying over school. Don't have it flying over the state capitol. Don't have it in a place of honor.
Mm-hmm. That should
be a given.
A place
of history rather than a place of honor, I think.
I wonder what it's going to take to take statues down.
Well, I spoke at Transylvania College last year, and Jefferson Davis went to Transylvania College. They don't have the statue of Jefferson Davis outside of the library in the rare books room. It is in the rare books room. I suspect noting that, and the rare books room is similar to a museum in a way. So they note the fact that this person went there, but they don't honor him. It's nothing to be rallied around. Rally around the flag. Don't rally around this particular statue. He's no one to emulate.
Right. I wonder how you can make that right for today. I mean, you could just take down the statue and leave a little plaque saying we have removed this statue because I think that would be interesting historically.
It's a teachable moment. And this is what once was the statue for Jefferson Davis, who led the Confederacy, was here. I think what I'm thinking of as an analogy is when they tore down the Berlin Wall, there were statues there.
They took down the statues
Saddam
of Lenin.
Hussein, Lenin, and but I think they remain in various museums. I think the fact that they were a part of that nation's history. There were several slaveholding presidents that we just note that they were slaveholding presidents. When we go to Mount Vernon, we note that there were slave quarters. When we go to the Hermitage, where Andrew Jackson lived, we note these things. They were an unfortunate part of their history and past. There is a fellow that I know, Darius Anderson, who honors Jack London. And when I ask him about Jack London's relationship to black folks, he said, well, we don't particularly honor that. We know it. We note it. The same with Woodrow Wilson. I was watching CNN History, C-SPAN 3 over the weekend. They were talking about President Wilson, who segregated the civil service in Washington, D.C., and was not noted as a pioneer in civil rights and human rights. And they acknowledge that.
And there, by the way,
here's the good things that he did, and here's the not-so-good things.
And there are also fine lines between honorable ignorance and real evil. I mean, I think some of these things that happen are out of ignorance. You don't realize what, when you put up the statue, you're not thinking.
At the time.
You're not thinking about, yes.
Well, again, you don't have to take the rights of other people into account. As long as he did right by our people, as long as the nation prospered, maybe at the expense of other people, as long as the nation prospered and people who look like me prospered, why should I care?
So
but you can't compartmentalize your conscience.
You can't, but that is part of the head in the sand ignorance.
And some people do it intentionally.
Yes, and the intentional part, as you're talking, I can see where putting up those statues is part of the dominance. It's part of letting your culture know who's in charge. And those people are kind of standing guard all the time.
Well, that's what it upset me with the making of the movie Glory, because Shelby Foote was a consultant on the movie. And in his whole three-volume narrative on the Civil War, he only has three paragraphs on black soldiers. And he said the only thing that black soldiers proved was they could stop bullets as well as white soldiers. And when Robert Gould Shaw, who's played by Matthew Broderick in the movie Glory, white led the black troops across the Boston Common, his mother said, oh, that God has been so good to me. Foote interjects, God hadn't been so good to her unless the only thing she wanted in place of her dead son was a statue. I called him in the Memphis phone book. This was before he was featured in the Ken Burns series, The Civil War. I said, Mr. Foote, how can you be a consultant on the movie Glory about the Massachusetts 54th when you have such feelings about the black soldiers? Well, he said to me, you got to understand about the N-word soldiers. And I still kept writing. He said, and I said,
what is it you have to understand?
Well, he claims the only thing that they did was stop bullets and that they really didn't deserve any real honor, and that his mother, Shaw's mother, shouldn't have been so proud that
totally
he led the black soldiers.
I totally missed the point on that. I thought you were saying, okay, that everybody's equal. Everybody stops bullets. I missed the point.
Oh, no. Deprecating these dark and deprecating their participation. And yet, here he was a guardian of that time. And if you didn't get it by Shelby Foote or have him associated with a movie, you couldn't get your movie made. And here's a guy that does not care anything about black soldiers being a part of the experts on black soldiers in the Civil War.
So you say you couldn't get your movie made. You couldn't get your statues built. So it seems that those who had the money to do these things
had beliefs that are antithetical to theirs. And here's another thing when you talked about have the money. It was black people that put the money together for the Shaw Memorial. It was their idea initially, and that's gotten lost in history. It was black people's idea to have a Veterans Day, Memorial Day.
Is that right?
And that's been lost to history. The Statue of Liberty was actually given to this country initially to celebrate us freeing the slave, and the first model of it was of a black woman in chains. In chains. But it would have been too offensive to the South.
Wait, are there pictures of such a thing?
Yes, there are.
I'd like to see that.
Yes,
I never heard this. See, I always learn something talking to you.
And it would be too offensive to the South, so they changed it.
That was what France first gave?
That is what Bartholomew, I think that the sculptor, first had in mind to give to the United States of America. But it was changed. And those people don't know it.
Never heard that in my life. My goodness.
Yeah.
Although every time I see something, you know, I mean, like so many people, I check into Facebook and I see posts, and a lot of them are yours, about historical moments that people don't know about.
Well, I owe it to a friend of mine who's still alive. His name is Alfred Sakle, T-S-A-C-L-E, the only one in the United States phone book. His family is from Greece. He was very proud of his Greek heritage, and all through elementary school and junior high, he'd say, the Greeks did this, the Greeks did that. Mm-hmm. What did the Negroes ever do?
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to mention it in passing to Mr. Aurelius Walker, who was then working his way through divinity school. He was working his way as a barber. And I mentioned it to him. He said, Mr. Griffin, if you give me part of your allowance, I'm going to buy you a set of history books.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and bought an entire set of J.A. Rogers history books before I left school, so I could come back every day when Alfred Sakle confronted me and say, we did this and we did that.
But, you know, that's not so uncommon for groups to do. They focus on their own contributions.
And don't see.
And that's the ignorance part.
Well, it's so wonderful in a city like San Francisco to have Chinese and Japanese. In fact, speaking of Japanese, I found something through Leon Litwack at Moe's Bookstore a couple of weeks ago, order number 65. And what it did was order all Japanese Americans in Marin County to report to a particular temple so that they could be shipped off to internment camps.
Hmm.
I froze when I saw that. And I was unaware of their history till a friend of mine, Ken Matsuoka, and I were playing gin rummy in the eighth grade, and we're keeping score in the back of a large pad. You flipped it over. It said Matsuoka Cleaners. Well, I knew his mother was a domestic and his father was a gardener. I said, I didn't know you owned a cleaners, and by the size of this pad, it was pretty extensive. He said, yes, but it was taken away from us.
It was taken away,
internment camps.
Yeah.
We never learned about internment camps when I was in school.
Okay, so I knew about those. I mean, it depends who's teaching what, I guess.
Is that right?
And I knew that all their property was taken away.
Now, did you learn about it in school and in a history book? Probably not.
Probably not. But we still learned about it from teachers.
Because I know John Hope Franklin wrote a history book in the mid-60s called Land of the Free, and he talked about the contribution of blacks, women, Asians, Native Americans, and the building of America. And the John Birch Society went after that book and said it was un-American.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was only there for 2 years, and it was taken down. Now, you look at the textbooks in the South, what they promote and what they don't promote.
Sure.
They justify, in many instances, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. They don't talk about the major contributions of Martin Luther King and other folks. You know, when
the Tuskegee Airmen. I mean, on and on and on.
Right.
Yes, there's a man I learned about recently from a documentary that Robin Friday did, and he was the barber of Birmingham. You know,
the unsung heroes.
But you know, life is so filled with heroes. Life is so filled with heroes. And how do you get everybody into the learning?
Remember Thomas Gray, full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bare. Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air. Everybody has a story to tell.
Everybody has a story to tell, I agree. And some people have exceptional, like this man who really put his whole family in harm's way.
That's right.
And I don't know why there's not a statue to him. I think we say that, by the way. I think the phrase, there ought to be a statue, is common. No, I mean, it's something we hear a lot. We know that that's the way of acknowledging true heroism. The issue is to find out who the heroes are and who are not.
Right. And does it have to be by consensus? It seems to me that somebody has to chronicle your story. Somebody has to tell the tale.
Yes.
And oftentimes it can't be you. I think John Oliver Killens came to Fisk the author of And Then We Heard the Thunder About Blacks in World War II, not one of whom received the Congressional Medal of Honor, although a million served during the time. And he said his daughter came home to him and said, "Daddy, Daddy, how come the lions are always killed by the gladiators in the arena?" And yeah, he said to her, "It will be that way, my daughter, until the lions learn to write
the
history books."
Until they can type, yes. Now, I have a thought just occurred to me, because you were talking about this woman who shimmied up the flagpole and dragged it down in a moment of... Now, we don't know that that's a moment of. She was probably stewing for years.
Oh, God,
there's no such thing as a moment of, I don't think. There's the moment you act on something you know. But also with Rosa Parks. Now, for years, forever, she was portrayed as a woman. She was just tired, and so she just sat down where there was a seat. And now I have read that, no, she didn't do that at all. She absolutely knew what she was doing.
She thought about it for a long time. There was another young lady who had a child out of wedlock who had refused to give up her seat, but they wanted somebody with a pretty pure and pristine background against whom they could not make other charges. And Rosa Parks certainly filled the bill. And
but
it
she
happened
filled whose bill? I mean, this was a
the
plan.
It was a plan to do away with segregation. There's always a plan to do away with segregation. It's almost the United States has a plan to invade almost any country in the world should they need to. One of the reasons that you had people supporting the movie Selma, even though it made a villain out of a person, in my estimation, who was not a villain, the argument was by the filmmaker is we're tired of white heroes. Mississippi Burning made the FBI the heroes of the situations in Mississippi. And they were not the heroes. Oftentimes they were in league or benignly neglecting what the Klan and others were doing. Black people, just as in the Civil War, had a hand in their own freedom. The 187,000 black soldiers who fought were ignored until the movie Glory. The strategy that Martin Luther King and others had during the March on Washington looked as if maybe LBJ encouraged it, but even though LBJ was not the president at the time, the Civil Rights Movement in 1965, the Voting Rights Act, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a lot of that, those pressures were imposed by black people who had a plan and shared that plan with others who were in a position to help make the legislation possible. Mm-hmm. So both were needed.
Both were needed. Okay, but still there is that stealing credit as you're talking.
Politics is,
really
Jesse Unruh once said, politics is the art of taking credit.
Okay. Thank you. Now, I want to know.
And as Napoleon once said, history is a fiction agreed upon.
I like that, too. What has become of this woman who ripped the flag down? What's her life like
you
now?
You know, I don't...
I want to know who's writing her a love letter. And will you do it? Take that upon yourself?
I should very well do that. And
she should be getting lots of them.
My law school classmate Hank Saunders, who was the first black state senator in the state of Alabama, who first climbed that flagpole many, many years ago to take that flag down. We should honor them both.
But now, so tell indeed about him, because we have a couple of minutes.
Well, Hank Saunders
so
came
this isn't
to
the first.
She was not the first. Hank Saunders graduated from Harvard Law School in the class of 1970.
With you?
Me. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make a difference. He went down to the state of Alabama, ran and won for the state senate around the same time Julian Bond was in the house there in Georgia. I remember working with him back in 1971. We were both working on the McGovern campaign.
So what did he do?
He was a representative for McGovern, and he went back and wound up running against John Lewis and had actually won, but not enough votes in the primary, but had to go in a runoff with John Lewis. And John Lewis work. And he's more of a man of the people. Julian Bond came from a very aristocratic background. Horace Mann Bond with his father. His sister was married to Howard Moore, who was the attorney that worked with Angela Davis. And very, very prominent background. I think he thought it was kind of his due that it would come to his way. I can't say that for sure because I didn't live there at the time. But I know John Lewis. He was my classmate at Fisk, and I know how hard he worked. Mm-hmm. And he was able to make his
way. So he brought that flag down.
He brought that flag down.
But it went up again.
It was a symbolic thing for him to bring the flag down. It wasn't legal for him to have done so. Mm-hmm. But it showed where the coming events often foreshadow themselves.
Okay.
And he was foreshadowing
because
what the future
was. What's her name again? Let's say it out.
I cannot
call
it.
I'm going to get it later and we'll write it down. But you know, we should know her name.
Yes, we should.
Because we knew it for the few days after it happened.
Yes, we
but it wasn't legal for her to do it either.
It wasn't. But civil disobedience, as Thoreau said, oftentimes is the way. But see, you have to, in order for civil obedience, disobedience to make its mark, you have to be willing to pay the price. And that's why I admire Martin Luther King. He was willing to break the law, but he was willing to pay the price. And his letter from the Birmingham jail showed
in order for civil disobedience to work, you got to have backup.
Well, yes,
because any administration can put up with civil disobedience and just write it out if it's going to fizzle.
Right. You cannot be the
general
without
any troops. You have to reach a point where it's not going to stop without the change.
Right. There comes a tipping point.
Oh, there you go.
And you don't know when that tipping point will be. In 1831, when William Lloyd Garrison started the anti-slavery newspaper, The Liberator, he didn't know. He was marched through the streets of Boston with a rope around his neck. And yet he fought and fought and fought and lived to see the Civil War and lived to see slavery abandoned. Now, somebody like Wendell Phillips knew that it wasn't enough. You had to have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And then he went on to fight for the 8-hour workday, for temperance, for women's rights.
So you're supporting something that I think anyway and have often said. Because, okay, slavery was abandoned. Uh-huh, fine.
But if you didn't have the Voting Rights Act,
if you didn't have a whole bunch of other stuff, and I think the truth of the matter is that no conversation is ever really over.
No. Evil is not over. The past isn't past. It isn't even finished. I'm paraphrasing very poorly Faulkner, but he's talking about the past isn't past. It isn't even finished. Yeah. And I think it's right.
So the issue is here.
Eternal vigilance.
Yes.
For liberty.
And to deal with each new day with some really intelligent compassion and willing to say, how could I have done this? What was I thinking when I put up this statue?
Yes, and be able to acknowledge that you were wrong.
Yes.
That's why I love the Southerners who have come to a point of view that they were wrong. They admit where they were. The people in the North, it's presumptive geographic liberality, and in the West, we're liberal because we live in California.
So
we're
not
liberal because we live
so
in
Illinois.
It's absolutely so
right.
not.
Right.
And I read a book on the history of
and anything. By the way, anything can take the form of a tyranny.
Absolutely.
So I mean, being liberal.
That's right.
We got to walk a fine line on that.
Goes against what we believe. We can't acknowledge.
Right.
Your enemy may have some wonderful good points. Acknowledge those good points. Try and build and grow on those.
Well,
good
not
points.
Only acknowledge them, but how unintelligent it is to write your enemy off.
As totally
just,
off.
Just oh, he's just such a. Bleh. Well, he may be a. Mm-hmm, but he's not just that. And if you don't know what it is your enemy is thinking or doing, you're in real trouble.
If you can't keep a line open of communications with somebody that you disagree with, the old phrase, let's disagree but not become disagreeable. I enjoy the people on my Facebook who don't agree with me, mm-hmm. Especially if they can do it in a civil manner, which I try to be.
Yes, you always are.
Start swearing or go into polemics and sometimes I just have to say, my rules, my site, and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the other ones that I can sit down and have a wonderful conversation with.
And you know, sometimes you ask somebody what they're talking about when they have some really truly disagreeable point of view in life, and you find out that what they're saying isn't actually really what you think they mean. I mean, there is that. People are not always so good at expressing themselves.
That's right. We tried to talk it over, but the words got in the way.
Yes. But even the truly evil people, and I will say that I do believe some people are just born bad, put that on my record, that you still have to know if you just toss them off.
Why is it that you feel that way? What happened?
No, maybe you feel that way for good reason, but you've got to stay alert. And if you're not, if you can't keep listening, you don't even know where the danger's coming from.
Right. With the old phrase, even from The Godfather, your friend's close, your enemy's even closer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that. I think you're defined as much by your friends as you are by your enemies. And if you can find out what it is.
Certainly your attitude towards them.
Right, because you not only are you responsible for your actions in life, you're responsible for your reactions. And to the extent that you can remain calm in the midst mm-hmm. of evil and still try and confront that evil, I think is the measure of a decent human being.
Oh, that's the measure of more than decent. I mean, myself, I have trouble staying calm even in the face of what I deem stupidity. That's not a good thing. Okay, so this isn't about me. But I would like to know how we're going to write love letters to this woman.
Well,
I think she deserves it. And by the way, does she have children? Won't her grandchildren be happy to see this? They won't know that she did this unless there'll be documentation. I look two generations down, and you do too as a historian. Right. When you find a pile of letters written, have you not hit gold?
Oh, I have every letter my mother and father ever wrote to me in college and law school.
Of course you do. But even when you find a pile of letters, you know, written by Roosevelt or, you know, somebody, I mean, that's
some letters my grandfather wrote to my mother, I found.
Yes, and you know something more about your family.
There's a wonderful letter that my father wrote to my illiterate former slave grandmother in Mother's Day 1920, and it's written in such a beautiful hand, and obviously somebody had to read it to her. Mm-hmm. But what his sentiments were, what his feelings were about his mother. He's told me I would have loved to have met her. She died in 1926. My grandfather died in 1916.
And what is that written in a beautiful hand indicate to you?
He was told that how important letters were, how important handwriting and legible handwriting was. He was told that he had the best hand in Columbia County.
Okay, so somebody was well-educated. I mean, you just learn so much about a person's background. I'm going to say, thank you for doing this with me. I could just keep you here forever, and maybe we'll just talk about some other historical thing another time.
You're on.
But I just want to say, if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, open your newspaper. It is filled with people who deserve love letters and would love to hear from you. And it just takes, as my mother used to say, you always have 5 minutes to sit down and write a thank you note to somebody. Wouldn't that be nice if we just did this en masse? So until next time, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.